Hello there, it's Mary Lou Tyler. This week's guest is Chick Herbert. Chick is a local Des Moines executive, and many of you know I part-time in Des Moines, Iowa. And I wanted you to meet Chick, and the reason for this podcast interview was for those folks who are in management positions who are always trying to eke out high performance from their team. Now, Chick has come up with a powerful process that taps into the human potential of your team and does so through the art of asking questions. Now, we all know in sales and in sales process, I harp on the ability to ask good questions is going to allow us to advance prospects through the pipeline. Well, here, the ability to ask good questions allows you to build and strengthen your management coaching skills in your company and allows your team to perform at the highest potential because you're really making a difference in lifting performance, but also improving morale. Here he is, folks, Chick Herbert.
I grew up on the south side of Des Moines and went to Iowa State, and then I actually did work in Northern California. I worked for a semiconductor business that was technically the manufacturing was in Singapore, but Milpitas was the headquarters.
Oh, right.
So
yep.
I lived in Mountain View
And
then worked in Milpitas. And then I worked for Motorola in Chicago and got lured back here many years ago by a small boutique consulting firm and never thought we'd live in Des Moines, but absolutely. Yeah, so happy we're here. Because I too love the city.
Yeah, and since we've been here, now granted, the first week we got here, I thought, oh no, this is not going to work because we were food centric in San Francisco.
You bet.
And when we first came here, I think we went to Court Avenue Brewery or something. I don't remember where we were, But the food presentation at the time. Although the food is delicious, the presentation was not something I was used to, and the plates were so huge.
Oh, gosh.
And I thought to myself, this is not going to work. Yeah. But it all worked out. And now we are definitely happy with all the choices around. Ingersoll is exploding with great restaurants. So
it is.
Pretty happy.
It is.
So is the NCMIC group, is that who wooed you back? And is that where you still are? Or what's the relationship there?
So this was the woo back was about 25 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And so I was with Wells Fargo for 13 and a half years. And I had three very different jobs. For the first 4 years, I ran a global sales team and worked across a fairly large sized organization within Wells Fargo. And then I've always had a passion for developing people. I'm an engineer by degree. So I'm technical in nature, but really enjoy people. And so the book blends both of those concepts together. And then I was responsible for the leadership development and the executive succession planning or talent planning for a big chunk of organization at Wells. It was about 60,000 people. Mm-hmm. So looking at who the next leaders were that we thought could be the CFO of the mortgage company or the next head of the credit card business, and what do we need to do from a strategic move and experience perspective, from a skill development, all the way down to frontline managers of what do we need to do to better equip them to lead their teams. Loved it, but I'm not an HR guy. I'm a business guy with a penchant for people. Mm-hmm. And so about 6 years ago, I moved back into the business on the executive team of one of our consumer lending businesses. And I was responsible for strategy and customer experience and design thinking and sales relationship stuff.
Wow.
And during all of that, I wrote the book, had to get approval from corporate counsel at Wells to do that. And then I take vacation and I do speaking and consulting around the book and other things. Mm-hmm. And NCMIC had hired my co-author to be the new CEO a couple of years ago. And so Mike had me in doing work here. Mm-hmm. And then they approached me and said, why don't you just come to work for us? And that's not why I do any of this. I'm really passionate about it, mm-hmm. and love it. And it allows me to continue to do what I'm really good at. And then also have my day job, which most of the time is stuff I'm good at, but not always. And so, they just made a really unique offer. And so I came here 6 months ago and they created a role on their executive team. So it's a new position to the organization. Mm-hmm. And I still do my speaking and consulting on the side.
And have that. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, and the relationship with Brad Williams, just because Brad is Brad, or have you worked across paths?
No, very good question. Cross paths in the short time I've been at NCMIC. So one of the things I'm helping lead the effort to get our sales. We have six different businesses within our walls, mm-hmm. all very independent, all do things differently, no common language, no methodology from a sales strategy. And so we're implementing Salesforce, and mm-hmm. I'm leading that effort as the executive sponsor. I've done a lot of sales development work. Mm-hmm. And so concurrent to that, we're creating an enterprise selling strategy. And that sounds more complex and glamorous than it is, because this is all small business selling, not mm-hmm. anything extremely complex. Brad's company, Dextra, is who we hired to implement. So they're the outside consulting firm that we hired to be the Salesforce implementers with us.
Okay.
And so,
got it.
And Brad has a really talented young woman named Christina Roeder, and she is his business development person. And so Christina was a great partner and has a real passion for developing sales process. And so she was very involved early, and we asked Brad if he wanted to come and sit in on a session that she and I co-facilitated. Mm-hmm. And I just struck up a relationship with Brad, and we've had lunch a couple of times, and he had approached me on my interest of joining the two of you and some of the other folks doing your workshop.
Oh, okay. I was wondering how this all fit together, because Brad is a connector. There's no doubt that he's.
Yep.
And he said, Mary Lou, you must get to know Chick. And I said, okay, well, you know.
Well, he oversold that, but
he's really amazing and fun. But we have yet to work together. We've gotten to know each other really well. We've had a number of different meetings over the years, but we have not worked together on a client project for sure. And this was the first attempt, after many, many years of talking about it, of putting together a workshop and understanding from that point of view how we can orchestrate it, who we should invite, who should be leading it. So it was a first attempt for us to bring together our talents, which actually work really well, because I do top of funnel to opportunity, and he does opportunity to close in this particular workshop.
Yeah.
So it was really a fun time to get together and try it out and see how it worked out.
You were happy with everything?
Yes. You know, I do these already, just the getting in the door part. So, you know, his piece was something I've heard him do before. And it was nice to give the audience the entire picture, because I literally stop at opportunity. And you know, from your now dealing with Salesforce, it's really an engine for opportunity to close. It's not necessarily a business development engine.
Right.
In fact, it's horrible at it. So I very seldom use or worry about Salesforce other than as a data repository to store the metrics and the sales conversation wrap up and all the things we need at top of funnel so that we have our waterfalls in place.
Well,
and that's the extent of my knowledge of my usage of Salesforce.
Well, and I'm excited. I have not ordered your book yet, but I am going to do that. And I really want to learn more about your work, and Brad speaks very highly, as do others, and would just love to understand that a bit more, because I've spent a lot of time in that space as well. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you even had a chance to look through the PDF that I sent you of the book. But one of the interesting things is that I think as an engineer, I was always taught that you need to understand where the constraint is in the process, because if you're not working on the constraint or the place that you've got the greatest difference between demand and capacity, then you're not really making meaningful improvements. Mm-hmm. And my experience on the sales side is a lot of sales leaders, one, they're not very good. Two, they use a one size fits all approach. So they will go into a team and have everybody focus on improving at this stage in the sales pipeline when not everybody needs help there. Other people may have a constraint in their pipeline in the next stage. And by opening up capacity or improving their skill in that one area, all you're doing is causing a bigger backup in the pipeline at the next stage. So I'd love to get your feedback as you read through those chapters, just to see if it aligns with how you think about things, if you disagree with it. You know, I just mm-hmm. would love to have the conversation.
I'll definitely do that. I think with me, it is all about relative position in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And so we have intra within the stage and inter from stage to stage metrics that align with the wrap-up of the telephone conversation or the email, whatever conversation they're having, whether it's email, social, direct mail, whatever. But it allows us to pinpoint via a scorecard process where people are getting stuck. And then the role playing and the huddles and the daily day in the life of the business developer is modified based on where we're seeing the data tell us that they're struggling, or where not working hard enough trying to cheat the system and game the system a little bit. So, you know, the first thing I implement
the same
is that.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you're approaching it from the form of a question.
Yeah. Because what my experience is, leaders will go in and tell people what to do, and this is how I did it because I was the gunslinger and the best salesperson that ever walked in the door of this company. And all of that is not digestible or meaningful or practical for somebody who has a completely different style. So how do you ask questions to get people to contemplate what their struggles are with executing that particular stage? How do you get people to recognize some of their own behavior that's getting in the way instead of just telling everybody how to fix it? Because by doing so, you're not creating any capacity and buy-in from that person. And I've worked with Fortune 50 to small private firms and every different function and dozens of different industries from healthcare to financial services. And one of the areas that I think are the worst coaches are the people in the sales world. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of telling. And not a lot of asking and not a lot of listening and not a lot of diagnosis as to how they can help.
Right. Or it's that sink or swim mentality. I mean, that's the way I grew up in sales. I, like you, am an engineer. I'm a computer software engineer.
Awesome.
And my career started by walking in the office one day, noticing it was a little bit quiet. And then the phone rang. It was my boss up in Sunnyvale. I worked in LA, saying, "Hey, Mary Lou, you know, we've had some issues, as you know, with selling this disruptive technology. So we fired all the salespeople and now all you guys are sales. Good luck."
Nice.
So, you know, that was my introduction into sales. Luckily, I had some good fortune of working at Xerox first. Yep. And they were heavy, heavy on training, especially of college grads. Even though I was a computer science major, they put me through their sales training program. And, you know, the Xerox sales training program at the time was top notch, probably still is if they have something. So I got training in an area that I was a little bit puzzled as to why they would want an engineer to be taking to sales training. But they explained it as, look, your clients are the employees at Xerox. You work in the data center and they're your employees. So, you know, they're your clients, and yep. that, you know, there are certain techniques and certain questioning habits that we want you to internalize so that you have a better relationship with clients. So they'll use the data center more. They won't outsource to others. I'm like, all right. So that remembering that helped me rise above this feeling of dread and driving home thinking my life is over because like, how could they do that? And it allowed me to think, all right, I'm a process expert. I'm an engineer. I've built operating systems. So I should be able to figure out at least like step one. You know, so that's how I got started. As I leveraged the knowledge I had with process, I looked at things relative position. I looked at things, what do I need to pass go? You know, what materials, what data do I need to collect? And then I, being a student and an engineer, we're always studying, trying to better ourselves. So I read everything I could from everybody I could on the subject and knew I didn't need to necessarily work on the process side of things because I had that. But what I needed was the skill set and the mindset. The mindset was the hardest thing for me to grasp.
You bet.
Is that, you know, because we solve problems as they come in. We don't necessarily have a habitual way of reaching out to people. It's not, we're more reactive than proactive in some cases. So that was a big aha moment of how to turn on a proactive engine inside of my head so that, not unlike brushing my teeth, I would make those 40 calls or send those. We didn't have email time. There was no internet. Yep. Or, you know, send those direct mail letters or visit, you know, sit in the parking lot at 6 o'clock in the morning waiting for the CEO to come in so we can have a conversation, you know, stuff like that. So I really want to understand what drove you from being an engineer, knowing process, and then attacking it from the question side of things, knowing that there is not a one size fit all, because when you're dealing with people, you're dealing with a myriad of things that can go wrong. I mean, so tell me what was that moment where you said, I need to get this information down on paper?
It's a great question. I think it was the frustration of witnessing so many ineffective leaders in all functions, but sales included, that talked a good game, but didn't have any method to their madness and would just go around and be the rah-rah cheerleader and get people fired up. And so in one of my roles, I talked about being responsible to help create a defined sales strategy and approach. Probably similar to a lot of the things that you've done. But my approach was not to go in and tell them what they were doing wrong and tell them this is how they need to do it right. It was to ask questions. So it was very consultative in nature, and it would be a simple question of, all right, Mary Lou, you've got this territory in Northern California. Tell me about, who do you call on? I mean, what kind of prospects fit into your sweet spot? And what's your strategy of covering this territory? And I was continually shocked at the responses that would be, well, you know, I do a swing up through Sacramento once a month, and then I always go over and I hit this area, and then I like to go down to this area, you know, and I just do that cycle on a monthly basis. And that was about as deep as the strategy went. And so over the course of the engagement, I would ask them a lot of questions. And as I'd ask them, I'd ask follow-up questions, and they would come to the conclusion themselves that that's probably not a very effective strategy. And so, and I'd say, well, would it be helpful if you thought about opportunities this way? One of my stories, I talk about, if you're going fishing, what's the most important thing? And people say, oh, the bait, the rod, the strength of the line, the reel, the time of day. And I respond that all those are really important, but the most important thing when you go fishing is you go fishing where there are fish. So are you taking time to think about where you're going to fish and have the highest likelihood to get some bites? Mm-hmm. And so through that whole process, we developed a common sales strategy that we would define and agree to. And then when we'd go to implement that, some leaders were much better than others at coaching and leading people around the new process. And the ones that were effective were the ones that invoked that same strategy. And so it was, how do we get people to take a different approach, recognize their job is not to just tell people, here's your unattainable goal and go get it and swim, but to understand the metrics, understand the process, understand where people, my terminology is one size fits one, not one size fits all.
I love that.
So what does Mary Lou need? What does Chick need? Is it skill? Is it knowledge? Is it at bats? And how do I use questions to develop those different needs? So it was an evolution, I guess, which would have been a much shorter answer for you. Sorry.
No, this is great. I am sitting here thinking, I know when I go work at clients, we're all gung-ho to put in something new. And we go through the training and we start working on the new thing and improving it. And then I leave.
Yep.
And then it just falls apart.
Yep.
So
exactly.
What in your process motivates them to continue on, that this is not a set it and forget it thing, especially with people? People are so variable.
Yeah.
That you can't just set it and go. You have to monitor it and nuance it. So how does this part of your process, when you're working with clients, with managers, with leaders, how do you instill that sense of honor to continue on with this so that the person, the whole person, is growing as a result of it?
Yeah. The linchpin is the leader. Mm-hmm. Or leaders, and you just have to have somebody at the appropriate level in the organization that is going to work at the right altitude, not too high, not too low, to ensure that it doesn't go by the wayside. And I think we give people way too much leeway to self opt out of things. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's not a full democracy. And there's always the, well, what about your top producer if they don't want to do it? Well, you have to decide if you're willing to be held hostage by them and the damage of them not participating. And if you're okay with that, then so be it. But I just don't think that that's, you can't let people openly and outwardly do everything to sabotage the process. That to me is not acceptable. So part of that is, from an accountability, you can stay. If you don't like it, you can leave. But there's not a door number three that you can stay and ditch. that's not an optional path. So. Mm-hmm. What do we need to do to get you on board? But what I found is the thing that motivates most people to continue is it works. And so if people are making money and being successful, that's the best way to create that accountability and desire to continue moving forward.
But you've also in the book indicated ways to track progress. So there's some visual components to this so that it's not all theory, because whenever I hear management and getting the people side of things, my head goes a little woo-woo sometimes, because it's like, how do you process or codify people and their behaviors and their attitudes? So, you've really shown here and demonstrated that a little bit of process, a pinch of process, and a little bit of management training and questioning go a long way coming together to create a process and a system and a method that you can maintain.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to, in a lot of companies that I've done work with, and I'm sure this is true for you, you become a bit of the company bartender where people will confide in you.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I believe causes a lot of unrest in organizations is that people don't know what's expected of them, and they also don't know how their manager is going to show up and which person is going to be there today. Is it going to be nice chick who's really happy and giddy, or is it going to be angry chick who tells me I'm doing everything wrong and I've got to do better? And it would appear that neither of those reactions are predicated based on me. It's really chick's mood. And so a lot of this does come down to the discipline and the predictability of the manager. So, for example, I sat in hundreds of meetings across the country where a manager would be meeting with an employee doing their one-on-one. And the employee would simply be sitting there as a passenger in this conversation because the manager would just do a verbal download of all of their wisdom. Mm-hmm. No questions, no confirmation of understanding, no questions around how they're going to apply what they're hearing, none of that. And so a little thing that I always incorporate is at the end of a one-on-one, I encourage managers to say, all right, Mary Lou, can you give me a quick summary of a recap of what we talked about and what we agreed to? And just by doing that, I'm shifting it from my agenda to now it's your stuff. Mm-hmm. And when we come back together, the first thing I'm going to do is, hey, Mary Lou, can you please provide a quick recap of what we talked about last week and what we decided? Mm-hmm. Just to get the discipline where we're not going to talk about it once and then it's on to the next fire the next week. And a lot of it comes down to getting people to apply. I'm not a big believer that we need a lot more training. I believe we need a lot more coaching because mm-hmm. training is acquisition of new knowledge, which is great and very important. But if I don't apply it, which is where the coaching comes in, it's not going to happen. So if I'm working with a salesperson to improve their ability to close deals and they're not an aggressive personality, they have a hard time asking for the business. We're going to talk about how they can overcome that, how can they close in a way that they're comfortable, and then they're going to go off and do it. And if I can observe them do it, that's great. But then we're going to debrief and talk about how that went and what worked, and did you get the deal or did you not get the deal? Mm-hmm. So it really comes down to how that is applied. And all of that, to me, goes back to the manager and asking questions to get people to think at that level.
The sales roles in many companies could be split amongst a business development team. There could be account executives who close the business, account managers, et cetera, et cetera. Are there different styles of coaching that you recommend based on what types of sales role they're in? The reason why I ask that is I'm finding from a business developer point of view where they're not necessarily working smaller number of deals because they're trying to find people to qualify and get mm-hmm. to an opportunity. So we're talking to a lot more people. There's a little bit more habit involved. Does that require a different type of manager than, say, someone who's going to be working with account executives and getting to close? Or can one, with your training or with this particular method, can one person do well in all facets of sales?
That's a really good question. I'll do my best to answer it. From my experience, what excites me about what we wrote about and what I talk to people about is it's universal and applies whether it's a relationship management role, a business development role, a CFO role, a product management role, a healthcare administrator role. The questions, so I think it applies everywhere and it can be mm-hmm. done by the same person, but I do think the aptitude and natural strengths of a person are going to influence their interest. So if somebody is really tactical and likes to have a lot of things coming through the pipeline quickly and the sales cycle is quick, that's very different than an enterprise strategic selling model that is going to take 18 months to 24 months to close. So mm-hmm. I think natural attributes of the leader and their interest in that product has a bigger impact on the success or failure versus their ability to use this approach and question-centric coaching. the types of questions that would be asked and the pace and the number of at-bats people have in those different stages, that's mm-hmm. certainly going to vary, but the underlying premise would be consistent.
Interesting. So the book is broken out into, what, four or five sections?
Four sections.
The first section is all about the fundamentals of coaching. Now, is this for the person who has already coached or is already in a management role, or could it be for aspiring coaches and managers, people who want, for example, I have a lot of folks right now, my clients, they have done really well in the sales development role. So the next progression for them, growth within the company, is to go to a lead role. I start freaking out when I hear that because they don't have any type of management training. So it's, you know, would this be applicable to someone like that who's thinking about, because they're naturally starting to ask good questions of their clients, of their prospects. So I'm just curious if this is something that people who are not really yet in the coaching or leadership role to take in and be able to apply.
Yeah, great question. And yes, the one thing that I've never seen is any data that correlates leadership or coaching effectiveness based on level or tenure.
Okay.
In fact, I think organizations put too much credence in the number of years of doing something. And is it that I've done this job for 20 years and every year I continue to grow and learn, and back to, you talked about that curiosity and learning desire as an engineer, so that I continue to evolve, or am I doing things the first year and I've repeated them for 20 years? To me, those are two very different people.
Right.
And I find a lot of folks would fall in that category. And there's the percentage at the tail of the distribution that are the growers and the learners. So I think that whether it's somebody who has been leading for a while, quite frankly, I don't equate them as being effective leaders just because they've done it a long time. I think this is really good for everybody. I consider myself successful. I consider myself, the level I work at in my day job is at an executive level, but I still follow the same principles. And I've seen enough of peers or similar level people that are really bad at this stuff. So I've seen enough train wrecks to know that it's not universally done.
And we don't help either, because here I am telling you that I'm worried about a high producing sales executive going into management. I have nothing to base that on. I just have a fear of it.
But you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think the attributes that make someone a great producer are not always the same attributes that are going to make them a great leader. I mean, if you're a great producer, it may just be tenacity. It may be you're going to bulldog through. I mean, it could be a number of things. But now you're shifting where you need to be responsible for not managing other people, but developing other people.
Right.
And that can often be in conflict of how they've been successful. So I share the same concerns. And I've seen plenty of failures where the top producer becomes the leader. But what I see is, and one of the things we talk about in the book is working on the system versus working in the system.
Yeah, I saw that in chapter 3 in that book. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great section to learn about, especially for me, alleviating my fears, because I just don't have a lot of insight into what to look for a good producer, as you say, an excellent producer who wants to grow within the company. The natural progression is going to be at some point into management.
Yeah.
And they have habit down, at least in my world, because they've proven over and over again that the routine is habitual in nature and that they're consistent and bordering on predictable. I mean, for the most part, very consistent. So to take that and then plop them into a role where they're now responsible for team performance and stragglers and Mm-hmm. You know, how is that going to work with a personality who's so driven and so disciplined to be able to pinpoint the areas of need in mm-hmm. the rest of the team? So, yeah. So this first section of the book is really great at essentially, it's like it's permission to be okay with that. you can definitely get there. But there are some warning signs. There are some key things that you really need to consider first before you make that leap.
Absolutely. And will they fundamentally enjoy the activities associated with that role? Because I mm-hmm. think people do aspire to move into a different role.
Right.
And my personal opinion is organizations sometimes undervalue an individual contributor role, and not everybody needs to aspire to be a leader of people. And what I think happens is most people that are in that mindset, or the organization just promotes them because they were the best whatever they were leading person, mm-hmm. they spent a lot of years crafting their ability to underwrite or to run technology independently, and now they move into this role and they continue to spend time back to the working on versus in. Those people, I think it's really natural for them to dive back into the system. So instead of helping, you and I used to be peers, I got promoted, now you work for me. Well, it's really easy for me to dive back in and rescue a deal that may go bad that you're involved in, but not bring you along from a development perspective simultaneously. So I saved mm-hmm. the deal, but I don't build any capacity in you. And
right.
it's easy for me to do that because that's where I spent my career, right? I was the best deal maker there was. But mm-hmm. that's not the sole responsibility. It's also to develop people. And doing it or telling them how you did it is not going to build capacity in other people. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
People can reject it. It's kind of like, if you're selling, you don't just go in and tell somebody about all the great things your product does, right? You mm-hmm. start with questions. Mm-hmm. You start by diagnosing what's going on in their world and how might you be able to help them. But that's not where you begin.
Mm-hmm. You're looking for those gaps to see if there's a good fit there. Truly a diagnostic process. And I think you're right. You know, I've seen it over and over again in my 30 years of working with salespeople is coming in, you know, saving the day, but yet there is no instruction of what happens after that, right. Or how did that happen? What just transpired? I mean, yes, you saved me, but how can I do this on my own going forward? What's the teaching moment here or moments here?
Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would profess that teaching moment doesn't start with the person who saved the deal going into a 2-hour dissertation about what they did. And I profess that it'd be good to say, well, Mary Lou, what did you observe? And let's take a step back and reflect on how we got into this position in the first place. And mm-hmm. how, when I came in, where were we? What are some of the things that you observed that I did that were beneficial? I mean, it's being very deliberative about that debrief process so that some learning takes place. Not just jumping in the car or airplane and parachuting into the next crisis.
Right. And the other thing that I like about this whole process is that we can also chronicle these dialogues, these exchanges in the form of a playbook or something that can help the rest of the folks coming up through the ranks mm-hmm. to look at certain situations or to listen to certain situations that happened, how that was overcome, what the teaching points were, and what the next steps were as we marched people down that pipeline. And I think that's another area that this is beautiful for is the extending that knowledge out to other team members who may be struggling, but not right now, but will be someday. And I think with all the tools we have now, shame on us if we're not doing those types of essentially those interviews or mm-hmm. what they used to call like debriefings, like you said,
after
the fact to understand what went well, what could we improve on, what we have done differently, how did you feel about that, what would you do differently, you know, what do you think the next stage step is, and et cetera, et cetera.
So. Exactly right. And as an engineer, I was an industrial engineer. I was taught plan, do, review. And so you talked about the debrief, and that's exactly the mindset. And the same thing, ideally, I'd rather, all right, let's plan this. I'm going to go on a call with you. Let's talk about our roles. Let's talk about how we're going to approach this. And again, if I'm the manager traveling with someone on my team, I'm going to be asking questions about, well, tell me about what you've identified as why we might be a good fit. Tell me about how they're currently managing whatever it is our product does. Tell me about what research you've done about the organization and where they're doing well and where they're, you know, it's getting people to think about that preparation, not just telling someone you need to be prepared. I think we make far too many assumptions that if we just tell people something, they automatically know what needs to be done. And in some cases, that's true, but not always.
And this applies to our prospects, too. I mean, this is so correlated to our prospects, you know, that we don't just assume that they're going to understand which option is best for them, that they're going to somehow, you know, feed through these three different things and figure it out. I mean, we have to demonstrate for them and start helping them understand which of these three options best fits them.
Exactly right. You're absolutely right. And one other point you talked about where you said you can document it in a playbook, which is what I've spent a good part of my career doing. We've done things with sales leaders, bringing in, say, divisional sales managers or regional sales managers, and talking about understanding where each person on their team, so their sales producers, where they struggle in their pipeline. So similar to what you get them to do, using the data and the metrics, but then talk about, well, how have you coached people around a constraint at this stage, at the close stage? What have you done? What kind of questions do you ask? So not only do we build sales playbooks, but we then build sales coaching playbooks so that they're not all having to reinvent the wheel, because there are only so many different things you can encounter. Let's capture those, understand those, and identify the types of questions we want to use to help build people's knowledge and skills in those particular areas.
I think the biggest aha moment for the listeners, I'm hoping, is, you know, this is not a passive process. This is a very proactive, very engaged process, and it requires you to get out of that command and control mode and more in, we're a team. We all have valuable input. We're all coming from different areas of knowledge, different experiences. And this really brings to point, I got a message today from one of my clients that they wanted to have a document that explained some type of hardware configurations. And it was asked by the sales executive that, you know, where is this document? So I naturally said, you know what? Great. This is a perfect opportunity for you to research what all of the different hardware options are. And let's present it in our next huddle so that we can talk about the strengths and weaknesses of each. We can talk about whether it makes sense to do a campaign around this, because if we're getting this question a lot, it's something that we want to hit, you know, as we go into a conversation, or maybe create a should ask questions document. So it's taking that spin of, I'm going to do this for you, and putting it rather, great question, great need. Let's have you manage that, getting collecting of the data, and present to us, you're a salesperson, present to us the why behind which one over the other. And they're glad to do that, but it's just so not natural for people to sort of take that and run with it.
Yep. I agree. And what a great way to engage your team, engage a person and give them a stretch assignment so that they can develop some additional skills. If you're going to present something, you know as well as anybody, you become a master of it. I mean, I'm not sure what the negative or the reason you wouldn't do that, other than it just isn't how we normally do things.
It's just not natural. I mean, sometimes even I, as a consultant, it's faster for me to do something, but I'm realizing, and this is before, you know, I have this great book to actually reinforce that, but it's helping me really understand that, yes, it may be 70% of what we want, but it's 70% that I'm not doing. Either. Right. It's basically 70% done, and we're going to fine tune and finesse and make beautiful the other 30%. And oh, by the way, we have a conversation around it. We talk about experiences we've had with clients. We've talked about all these things that help us understand the story behind the need for this. So it just opens up the ability for the reps to have deeper conversations, more meaningful conversations. So it's just a win-win. But taking that mindset and saying, yep, this is great. And you're in charge. You're in charge. Go figure it out. Here's the stuff that you need to do that. And then we'll put it together as a team and make it a production document in this case that we can use throughout our sales process.
And I think it's a great opportunity for that leader. So even through the development of this document and the discussion with the sales team, as a leader, I'm going to stay engaged with that person.
Right.
So I'm going to coach them through that process as well. Mm-hmm. And to the extent, it's going to depend on the person. But I may say, rather than say, you know what, here's what you need to do first, which is what most command and control leaders would do.
Right.
My approach would be, well, tell me about walk me through what you see the four steps of this process entailing. How are you going to start? And not because I don't trust them, but because I want to, by asking that question, one, it helps me assess their critical thinking skills in an environment or in a process that's different than what they do every day. Mm-hmm. The whole point of the book is, how do you develop the critical thinking skills of your team? How do you improve your position of leverage as a leader because your team is better equipped to solve problems on their own and they don't need to be coming to you in a panic? And so this is a great opportunity to do that outside of the traditional pipeline or whatever it is that they're doing. And you're right. It's a different habit that has to be formed. You have to get in the habit of asking questions. Quite frankly, I think you need to prepare for those conversations differently. Most managers just wing it because their conversations are pretty surfacey.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not used to asking questions, write down a few questions that you can ask just to get the conversation started so you're not dictating it. And use silence as your friend or ally and not the enemy. I think leaders that do try and ask questions, if the other person doesn't respond immediately, they feel compelled to fill the dead air and give them the answer. And I think asking a good question, silence is the evidence of a good question because it means that they're contemplating it. Let them contemplate. You ask the question, let them think about it.
Mm-hmm. And your section two of the book really helps us understand the fundamentals of questions and the basics, but also the strategic use of them, which is very helpful. I think because we're all kind of like, how do I ask a good question, or what's a good question? But we know how to do this. If we should know how to do this, or at least work on doing this to that implication question process that we learned with the spin selling methodology that helps us help people think outside the box and challenges a bit and pokes them a little bit. So we kind of know how to do that pretty well, but we're dealing with our own people. So there's a way to approach that. And I think you're right. I think listing them all down, kind of getting an understanding of what the outcomes that you're looking for, and then backing it up into what types of questions you could ask to understand how they view that outcome is really important.
Yep. No, I agree. I mean, there is, some people are very inquisitive and just naturally ask questions, but there is a strategy of using questions.
Right.
And it's learnable. It's not,
right.
You can repeat it. And I always tell leaders that it isn't their natural habit. You don't need to have 50 questions in your tool belt. Mm-hmm. I ask the same question often. and back to being predictable. By doing that, if I ask a question every time we meet, well, over time, you're going to come in prepared to answer that question because you know I'm going to ask it. So I'm changing behavior by me asking questions.
Right. Right. I love that. And this section of the book, for those of you, is great to hone your skill for asking questions of your prospects, for business developers and AEs alike. This is a really great section of the book that helps you think about the complexity of questions, how to approach them from a relationship and trust point of view, and really valuable information, regardless of whether you're doing this type of coaching or managing, but also if you're working with people who you don't really know very well, and you're trying to get some engagement out of that conversation. When we move to that section 3 now, we're actually implementing. And this is, I think, where we really start seeing the value of preparation. As you said, you prepare, you execute, you review, which is, you know, that's so great to see that. So this is the actual execution. And you know, are there certain areas there that you wanted to point out for people that you think really differentiate what you're trying to do in this book versus some of the other management books that may be out there for sales management? Are there certain things within this section that you want to highlight for us?
A couple of things. One would be you have to get to know your team, in most cases, at a deeper level than you know your team today. And you may know them because you've worked with them for 10 years, you know about their family. But, for example, have you ever asked them a question of what motivates you? What part of your role do you think you do the very best and why? Mm-hmm. And so trying to get underneath the skin and have more meaningful conversations. And interestingly enough, I'm doing a session with some leaders in healthcare. And there was a survey of pre-assessment of their skills in different areas. I think people have a tendency to overrate the level of trust with their team, their ability to communicate effectively, and their overall leadership skills. Because part of this is getting to know people and having a high trust relationship where they're willing to speak the truth to you. Right. And I've found in a lot of places that does not happen. I've got two sons that served in the military and one's still in, and he's an intelligence analyst. And I love the term truth and ground truth. And truth is the truth that you hear from your command and control station. And ground truth is what's going on in the real world.
And I love that.
There is often a very big difference between those two. Mm-hmm. So talk to a leader like, oh no, my team, everybody's engaged. They're doing a great job. I've got a really high trust team, great communication. You go talk to people and they're like, absolutely not. I'm afraid to say anything. So yeah, how do you get to know the team and get to that one size fits one so that you really know how you can help people improve? Mm-hmm. The other thing would be, especially in the sales world, which I know a lot of your listeners are in, understanding where people have a constraint in their sales process and using your tools to identify that so that you're applying a one-size-fits-one instead of a one-size-fits-all. And so mm-hmm. really that diagnosis of where to coach, if you've got metrics, which a lot of organizations do, that's great. But I've found even with those metrics, they don't really use them from a coaching perspective. They use them from a managing perspective, saying we got to get more deals through the pipe, but mm-hmm. they're not doing anything to help figure out how to accomplish that. Telling somebody they need to increase their production and asking some questions about what's getting in the way are very different conversations.
Right. Right. And I think they do have, like you said, they do have data, but maybe not specific to location in the pipeline necessarily, mm-hmm. where things are getting gunky and stuck. I mean, that's what I found. Like you said, they're looking at global overall type numbers, summaries, instead of detail inter and intra stage metrics that help us understand where the conversations are failing.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that goes back to, I see so many leaders that are working at the wrong altitude. Mm-hmm. So they're either working so high And the analogy I was using on in another meeting today, I was driving in my car this weekend and I was in an area that I didn't know. And my GPS in my car was zoomed in really close. So, you know, maybe a quarter mile around my car. Mm-hmm. I was panic stricken because I didn't know what direction I was going and I didn't know how to proceed. I zoomed out and went up and got context to some big landmarks. Okay, I got it. Now I know mm-hmm. where I'm going.
Right.
If I'm zoomed way out, it doesn't help me because I can't even see the road I'm on. If I'm zoomed in too far, I see way too much detail of the road and everything right around me. Mm-hmm. I've got to figure out that altitude as a leader that I need to work at to effectively transform my team and my organization.
And that's a great analogy. I love that.
Thank you. Thank you.
It really focuses on the fact that it's a variable. This whole thing is variable in nature from the standpoint of people are variable, but it's also, there's a lot of areas where you can stockpile knowledge and assistance because mm-hmm. we've been down that road before in some other capacity with some other person mm-hmm. and are mm-hmm. able to now create a library of, here's the things that where we've been, here's the obstacles that we were able to overcome, here's some of the new challenges that we're working on now. Isn't this fun?
Right. And that's how you right. have to look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's all changing, and that altitude is different for every person on the team because of what they need. So it's, to me, that's what makes all of this fun, is you really have to be in the game to understand what people need at what time, and that is always evolving because people are growing and changing.
Mm-hmm. So the book is It Begs a Question, Chick Herbert. It's Learn How the Best Managers Drive Performance Through Question-Centric Coaching. Now, is that your terminology, question-centric coaching, QCC?
It is.
Great. What's the best way that we can continue? We'll get the book, of course, on Amazon. Is there other ways that we can get to know you, your process, your training, what's available for us to learn more? Where would we go do that?
I do have a website. It's not a super robust website, but it does have quite a bit of information on it. And the website is questioncentriccoaching.com. It's a long URL, but questioncentriccoaching.com. And it you can also purchase the book there, but it talks about the premise and some of the other services and the work that we do. And I just thank you for the opportunity to spend time with you today and talk about it. I'm very passionate about it. It's not, I didn't write the book because I aspired to write a book. I wanted to write the book because a lot of people said you should write a book to help more people do this because it works. And so it's not something I turn on and turn off. It really is in my DNA and I'm passionate about it. My goal is to try and eradicate bad leadership. And there's unfortunately too much of it around.
I was going to say that's lifelong work that you're talking about now.
Because it's probably a little too aspirational.
But I do believe that, you know, what I've learned in this conversation is that, you know, if you really want to become a great coach and manager, you can, you know, and are thinking like I thought, where, you know, I'm great at process. I'm a little bit not too sure about people, but obviously for me, I'm a coach. I'm a consultant. I'm dealing with people all the time. And, you know, under having those tools in your tool chest of how to get people to engage, how to get them to do the work that needs to be done at hand and have fun doing it and enjoy it and want you to come back later if you're like a consultant like me for that next project. You know, it's really great to have this side of the knowledge understood, practiced, applied. And really, this is a planning, execution and review process. So it's never ending. And I love the way that the book is laid out because you can really consume it and start applying, consume it and start applying. It's like a manual really, or a reference book, which is a nice way to write a book, I think, is go back to it. I'm sure you have a lot of readers who've earmarked sections of the book where they go back and review all the time. So that's the mark of a good book for sure.
Well, that is as nice of a compliment as one could get. So thank you. And that was the intent. It wasn't to have it be a big theoretical book mm-hmm. that you didn't know what to do.
Right.
I'm a pretty simple person. It's a pretty simple book with some icons and graphics to convey points. Mm-hmm. But the intent was to give people that they could literally use tools in their very next conversation.
Very good.
It's as simple as that.
Wonderful. Well, Chick, thank you so much for your time. Very much appreciated. I'll be sure to put all the links and things on Chick's page, everybody. So for those of you driving and don't have time to write something down, don't worry. It'll be all out there. And the book is, again, It Begs a Question, Learn How the Best Managers Drive Performance Through Question-Centered Coaching. Thank you, Chick, so much for your time.
Thank you, Mary Lou. I really enjoyed it and appreciate the opportunity.